Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 17th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon is David Peters, and he will be speaking on affirmative action or affirmative racism. Let's listen in on David Peters.
It's quite clear that the abandonment of affirmative action as we know it will be part of his political platform. Is there any Californians here?
Yeah, a bunch.
Well, listen, I need to test my reading or hearing here. I thought I heard sometime back that Californians will have an opportunity to vote in a referendum this coming year. Does anyone know on whether affirmative action should be abolished in state agencies for jobs funded by the state? Does anybody know?
I haven't heard about
that. Well, maybe that's pure mythology.
It would be one of those knee-jerk things anyway.
So. No. It's a referendum that's still trying to get the requisite number of signatures.
Oh, is it? So it's not even on a drawing board yet. It's not on the playing table.
No, the idea was to have it on the playing table in 96 to coincide with the presidential election.
Well, we shall hear more about this, and I think it's worthy to give our attention to this. It certainly is timely to talk about it. What I ultimately, I'm going to assume today that affirmative action, as we know it, in hiring, promoting, admittings to schools and contract awards and so forth. Let me just assume that it is currently being placed in jeopardy. Let me also assume that maybe the lion's share of the American public is about ready to put a sunset clause to affirmative action, which began back with LBJ. And so probably the most worthy thing to do against that background of suppositions would be to trot out an argument. See, in law school, you never know whether, you know, what side of the street you got to walk. Either, you know, today you're going to be for the prosecution, tomorrow for the defense. So what would be the most productive argument ultimately for us to hear? It would be an argument, I think, in favor of keeping affirmative action. Let's just assume that that's on the losing side or the one that's in jeopardy. So let's just hear what that argument might look like, a few planks in that particular platform, and then we can talk about it. Little conceptual clarification. What do we mean when we talk about affirmative action? How would you know it if you ran into it? Let me just, in a broad brush way, draw a distinction between what might be called weak affirmative action and strong affirmative action. Now, I don't think that weak affirmative action really ruffles anybody's feathers. It's strong affirmative action that's going to be the one that is going to be difficult. One way of defining terms is to define by way of giving an example. So let me give you an example of weak affirmative action. I lived through this, maybe 3-4 years ago when our department was going to hire a new person to come on board. And here's what we had to go through in order to meet affirmative action requirements laid down by affirmative action officer. And this is, I'm giving you, is a case of what I call weak affirmative action. I got a checklist from our affirmative action officer, and there were things on it like this. Have you advertised this position in the following publications? And of course, some of them were real easy, like the University of Wisconsin system announcements of opportunities available. And then where it got interesting was check here if you have placed a display ad in the publication called Black Issues in Higher Education. Yes or no? Check here as to whether you have placed a display or classified ad in some journal aimed basically at Hispanics. check here whether you have sent announcements of this vacancy to there were certain things in the Bureau of Indian Affairs or something which makes publications of job openings, and you see, to the extent that I did not check any of these, I had not fulfilled the requirements of the affirmative action. There had to be public announcements made in all of these places. And now you have to ask, well, why are we into this business? Because what we want to make sure we've really done is to make sure that all of the minority communities that may have qualified candidates are alerted to the opening of this post in the University of Wisconsin system. Okay, we have to really beat the bushes, make sure that we haven't just had a circumscribed advertising campaign. We have to have the widest advertising campaign possible, so we leave no stone unturned in turning up possible applicants from minority groups. But then the interesting thing is, what happens after we've done that and the applications start flowing in? Our task then, in this case, was to hire the best qualified candidate, period. There was no preference whatever given to Native Americans, Hispanics, blacks, or anything. We are now charged with hiring the best qualified candidate. So our affirmative action took the form of merely apprising the community of minorities as well as the community of whites concerning this opening in order to have the greatest influx of applicants. But when push comes to shove, you're going to take the best qualified one. Now, the times have changed because 9 or 10 years ago we went through this exercise, and our vice chancellor would go over this and simply say, why is it on your short list, the ones you invite for interviews, I don't see any women on here? I mean, were there no women applicants? Now I'm starting to take heat here and say, well, yeah, there were. Well, why did you reject the woman applicant then? You see what's at stake here. Or was there a woman applicant on your short list? Yeah? Was she brought for an interview? Right. Well, why didn't you hire her? Now, I'm starting to take the heat here because, you see, a premium is put on getting women into these positions, and the burden of proof was on the hirer, namely me, as to why I didn't hire the woman. But that's all gone. That's all gone. It's gone. That pressure is gone with respect to minorities, including women. I call that weak affirmative action. Strong affirmative action takes this form. It's a form of favoritism in hiring, in promoting contract awards or admittings to school, which gives favoritistic treatment based, let's say, on race. Forget about gender. All you women know that you're no longer a minority anymore. You've risen here now, so you're not the same league, with blacks and Hispanics and Native Americans. But strong affirmative action can take two forms. I'm telling you that it's favoristic, that it's preferential. It could take a weak form in that, let's suppose that you have two equally superiorly qualified candidates, and one of them is a black and one of them is a white. Then a form of strong affirmative action would be if, in that circumstance, you used race as a tiebreaker. Right? They're equally qualified, equally strong, but notice that it's preferential in that you allow race to be a tiebreaker. The more problematic form of strong affirmative action, which is still preferential, would run like this. That if you selected someone for a job or for a promotion or for admission to a graduate school, let's say a black, who was less qualified than some white, got it? And you still gave the nod to that person. So that's a more problematic form. It's still preferential. You're giving the nod because of racial identity, but not as a tiebreaker anymore. But now you're willing to choose a a less qualified black over a more qualified white. Now, either of those two forms would count as strong affirmative action. And I think that probably the only kind of affirmative action that's worth talking about, whether we should preserve it or not, is really the latter. Because for the former, doesn't give probably any of us any, you know, weak affirmative action. Just make sure your advertising campaign is far out enough, probably, is not a matter of moral moment. Now, I'm going to make a wager here. I think that those like Pete Wilson and maybe Newt Gingrich thinks this way, I think George Bush thought this way and so forth, I think the major or a major difference in the belief set of those who think that in 1995 now we can safely abandon strong affirmative action after 30 to 35 years. The difference between people who think that, well, I think you know, we can just kiss it off, and those who say, I think we still need it. I think a major difference in these people is their differences, to use a Virginia Slims thing, as to how far we've come, baby, since the executive order from LBJ, which started the affirmative action. I think that the George Bush School and perhaps Newt Gingrich and perhaps Pete Wilson are animated by this view. They think, look, affirmative action has been around for 30 or 35 years. It has accomplished its purpose. We have overcome, basically, racism in this country. Yeah, I mean, the victory's not been completely won, but, you know, racism right now, things are a lot different than they were back in Governor Flava's days. I mean, racism now, it's not been just KO'd. It exists in isolated pockets in a shallow way. You know, our fundamental institutions aren't strung out with racism. And so, you know, I think it's safe now to simply abandon strong affirmative action laws, which are there to ensure preferential treatment and so forth. Those laws, I think these people are right now not holding doors open to blacks that would otherwise be closed. Then you've got those that say, you've got to be kidding. If you think that racism in this country has been KO'd and expurgated from our culture, you're big W wrong. I mean, these are people who say, ha, you think that racism is shallow, just exists in isolated islands? I mean, these people claim it's alive and well in 1995. It's insinuated in the fundamental structures of our society. We've not come a long ways, baby, and we're not yet in a position to put a sunset clause on affirmative action. So I think that part of what's at stake here is a certain factual belief about how far we've really come in conquering racism, which is divergent among these groups. Here's what I want to do today. There are a number of candidates for what are called minority groups who are to be given special consideration under strong affirmative action, blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, and so forth. Let me just concentrate for our discussion today just on the issue of blacks. Let's just fine-tune it to blacks, and I'll tell you why. If we can't make the case for why affirmative action of the strong sort should be continued for blacks, then I think we're probably going to have less a case makeable for Hispanics and Native Americans. So, you know, let's just concentrate on blacks for the sake of convenience, thinking that if we can't show why strong affirmative action should continue for them, then I'm not sure I'm going to be very confident about us making a case for the other groups. Now, there are really two different justifications or reasons for getting into and maintaining strong affirmative action. One, and in this case, the rationales or theories as to why we should have strong affirmative action, I mean, the fact that there are two shows that this issue is a lot like the capital punishment issue that we talked about last week. If you're pro-capital punishment, you can deal from one of two decks. You can plump for capital punishment on the grounds of what is called the deterrence theory, You know, if we have capital punishment, we'll send a message out there to would-be bumper offers of Uncle Charlie that, you know, if they do it and they follow through and they get caught, they're going to get fried, and it's going to scare off people, all right? But then you got the retribution rationale, which simply says, I don't care whether we scare off future murderers. We should have capital punishment because the guy deserves it. Right? I mean, so there's two different theories. One is forward-looking. We're trying to prevent the loss of innocent lives in the future by capital punishment. The other is backward-looking and simply says, look at this horrible deed that's been done. Something needs to be done. The blood of the ground cries out for justice and so forth. You know, likewise, in the affirmative action debate, we have two different theories. One is an entirely backward-looking theory, and it would purport to giving preferential treatment to blacks on grounds of compensation for past injury suffered. Now look, all of us believe that a major principle of ethics is that if you have harmed someone, you owe them one. You ought to make amends. You ought to compensate for the harm done. So one rationale for having strong affirmative action is a backward-looking one. It looks at the history of racism. It looks at blacks who have been disenfranchised and so forth, and says, you know, we have done dirt as whites to these people as a class, and now it's time for amends making, and now you justify a strong affirmative action as an amends making compensation for past wrongs which have been done. Fade to gray. There's another rationale, which is not at all backward looking. It doesn't purport to justify affirmative action on the basis of compensation to wrong parties. Rather, doesn't care about that. It's entirely future-looking. The way it would justify affirmative action of the strong variety is it would say, look, here's our goal as a nation. We want to bring about, in the future, a society which is more just. And what we're referring to here, we want to bring to pass a society in which blacks and whites can equally have an equal opportunity to compete on equal terms for jobs and for the more desirable and lucrative positions in the hierarchy of business and the professions, which jobs are really the gateway to a decent income or more advanced income, and all of us know that income is the gateway to greater opportunities. So the futuristic looking one doesn't look backwards. It's not trying to put anybody on a guilt trip. It simply says, here's what we want to bring about. This more equal opportunity in the future to compete equally in equal terms of blacks and whites for the various positions there are, and we're going to get into strong affirmative action as a way of bringing that about. You see, it's futuristic. Now, let me just tell you why, at least as of today, I'm inclined toward, if I would have to defend strong affirmative action and keeping it, why I'm inclined toward this futuristic rationale rather than the backward-looking compensation rationale. I think that the problems which ensue if you try and fight for affirmative action on the grounds of we need to make amends to harmed parties for past injustice to them, I think that this procedure is so loaded up with difficulties that I don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. I think there are difficulties that attend to futuristic orientation too, but I think the difficulties are more forbidding for me with a compensatory rationale. Let me just tell you why, just in a nugget. I really didn't discover until a couple years ago, in which I was walking my kids through Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Now, the Aristotle I'm talking about is the real one, you know, not the one that married Jackie. I mean, most of my students get confused about this. This is not the one that married Jackie Kennedy, you know. But the real Ari, it just struck me as amazing as we went through here as to how this guy writing, you know, 4 centuries BC, in the 4th century BC, could have such an important thing to say to the issue of affirmative action. Amazing. But if you're tinkering with the notion of trying to defend strong affirmative action on compensatory grounds, you know, making amends for wrong done in the past, Aristotle lays down a set of criteria for doing compensatory justice. Now listen to this. I mean, it strikes me as really right-minded. First of all, according to him, the amends maker should only be the party that has done the harm, and not somebody else who didn't do the harm. The party to get the amends, the compensation, should be all and only those who have actually been harmed. Got it? And the third criterion laid down by Harry is that you know that the amends making is big O over when you've restored that party to the position that he or she would have been had not the harm occurred. Now, that strikes me as that's pretty sane. Let's just apply this. Let's just see how this would work out, assuming it's a plausible criterion, in the modern day if you wanted to retain strong affirmative action on compensatory grounds. All right? Here's what my male students tell me about this. They tell me, look, and I believe they're honest. They tell me, I have never discriminated against anybody. I am a new breed. I don't discriminate against women, and I don't discriminate against blacks. And you know who takes the hit when you start pounding the pavement looking for a job? I take a hit. I get parked out of jobs because the preference is given to blacks. And therefore, they're simply saying, with respect to Aristotle's first criterion, that the amends makers should be all and only those who have done the harm. They feel as though that criterion has been violated. They're taking a hit for a harm they never perpetrated, and it ain't fair. Then we have the other side, namely, how many people of black color who walk in and apply for a job or apply for a promotion, can you say in truth that all of those, I'm talking about 1995, have in fact suffered the problems of victimization of past discrimination? I mean, is every black person that you give preferential treatment a victim in 1995? Probably not. And so now you're walking this problem of making amends or giving preferential treatment to people who don't deserve it and violating Aristotle's second criterion. So I'm worried about trying to defend strong affirmative action on compensatory grounds, because I think it's more probable than not that people are going to take the hit, make amends, like white males who don't deserve it because they never perpetrated any harm, and there are going to be people receiving compensation that don't deserve it, and I get nervous, you know, about these kind of problems, so I say, oh, well, let me just cut bait, and maybe I'll be in less trouble if I try and walk the futuristic stance, you know. I'm not sure I'm going to be, because, you know, the old saw, well, does the end justify the means? Ha, ha, ha. I mean, if my end out there is a more egalitarian society, does that mean any means that I use to bring about that end are okay as long as the end is honorable? I mean, can you use unjust means of achieving a just end? Wow. I mean, these are the problems that I've got on that side, but let me just live with it for a bit. Now, there really are two kinds of racism, I think, which we can distinguish. Let's distinguish, first of all, between overt racism. Overt. This is racism in which the perpetrator's own racial bias or biased intent is the reason as to why preferential treatment is given to whites. I mean, here I'm talking about people that simply, I don't like them kind. I mean, I don't know, I feel defiled by associating with them. Or they're the scum of the earth, or they were meant to serve whites, and so forth. I mean, that would be overt racism. You can have a more subtle form of it. If some employer is favoritistic toward whites and tries to park out blacks from positions because he's afraid that if he does hire on board blacks, that some of his customers might take a walk, they might be offended by blacks on staff, or some of the other white employees might be offended. You know, I still count it as overt racism. Then you've got institutional racism. This is more subtle. This occurs when blacks are adversely affected by policies which really are racially neutral, but have the effects of an adverse impact on blacks. Consider, for example, a layoff policy. Last hired, first fired. Well, look, most employers have had to get their act in gear since the passage of the Civil Rights Act since 1964. And not surprisingly, the last hired mostly are blacks, right? And so if it comes layoff time, and you have a last hired, first fired, well, I mean, it doesn't say that all blacks have to take a walk, but functionally, most of the blacks are going to go because they happen to be the category of the last hired. So it has an adverse impact, although it's not racially biased in itself. How about selecting candidates or hiring policies that work through what is called the old boys network? I mean, every one of my students, you know, who goes to the career counseling service over at my university, the first day they say, you got to start networking. Networking, this is, you know, jargon. Start dropping your name among your contacts, you know, who are in business in the country clubs and athletic clubs, you know, where you go. Just start telling them that you're interested in it, what you're, you know, okay? Now look, just in a nanosecond you can figure out as to why hiring by way of this word-of-mouth contact network is going to have an adverse impact on blacks. I mean, who are most of the employers? Who are most of the foremen? Who are most of the union members? I mean, they're white. Whites hang around with whites. Blacks aren't in the same country clubs, the same athletic clubs, the same churches, and so forth. And so they're parked out of this network. And if you're hiring people, simply say, hey, if you know anybody, you know, to fill this job, you know, let me know. Well, if you use the network, it's not intrinsically biased against blacks, but it has this adverse effect. Another institutional form of racism, which is linked to the last hired, first fired, is selection, let's say, for training programs to move from an unskilled position to a crafts position or something, right? Training programs offered by the company on the basis of seniority. Well, I mean, the whites are probably going to have a lock on seniority because they've been there longer. I mean, it's not meant to exclude blacks, but the functional upshot of it is that it does. Well, these are really two forms of racism, and the cumulative effect of both of these, I think, yields this. And this is a perspective. If you just ask most people, where do you basically see blacks in terms of employment? Well, it's all in lower level jobs, house cleaning, you know, and lower level work the earth, dirt jobs, and this kind of stuff. And the perception, like, well, that's mostly where they are, leads to the view, unthought through, is this, well, that's probably all they're qualified for, right? I mean, it leads to this kind of perception here. How are we doing with respect to racism in this country? Let me just walk some things by you here of recent vintage to say that I don't think that you can make successfully a case that we have come a long ways, baby, in terms of overcoming racism. Most of my evidence here is from the last 5 to 6 years, so I don't think it's, you know, before the last glacier went through. I mean, it's relatively recent stuff. Newsweek in 1987 carried a big article, January 5th, outlining in overwhelming detail this growing pattern of bigotry and animosity toward minority students at predominantly white campuses. I mean, it's true on my campus. 5,000, bunch of Norwegians and Scandies, you know, that are at my place here. They're from Minnesota and Wisconsin. You know, we're nice there. I mean, we're not, you know. I mean, last year, we only have maybe 3 or 4% blacks. We worked like mad to try and get a black student population. Last year, somebody hung a sign on a dormitory room of two of our black students that says, "Get out of here, niggers." I mean, it just stunned us. I mean, I didn't think we were capable of this. You know, in 1988, we had the advent of the white supremacist movement. Violent, skinhead kids, you know, with weapons that include knives and baseball bats and steel-toed boots. I mean, this springs up all over the country. You shouldn't be surprised in capital punishment cases. Most of the states that are really gung-ho for capital punishment are in the states of the old Confederacy. Brute facts of it, guys, is that, you know, you're three times more likely to get sentenced to the electric chair for murder rather than life in prison as an alternative if you're a black who has killed a white than if you're white has killed a black. That's just a brute fact, which I offered as lingering racism. A couple of guys named James and Williams in a book called A Common Destiny in 1989, they document how highly educated blacks face barriers in living in the same neighborhood as highly educated whites. They just seem to be, you know, shunned. I don't know if I can go on. I have three pages of documentation concerning how racism is really alive and well. I mean, one of the most stunning things is 3 years ago, the Urban Institute in Chicago did what I would call just a marvelous controlled study. They got a bunch of young black people in their 20s, college educated, a bunch of young white people in their 20s, and they matched them up in terms of academic credentials, past experience, articulateness in their give and take in conversation. They dressed them up in Brooks Brothers suits and so forth, and then they went through the classified ads in Washington, D.C. and in Chicago and sent both of these out at different times to apply for the job. Surprise, surprise. I mean, it was just absolutely overwhelming. I mean, we have equally qualified candidates. I think white guys, according to this study, were four times more likely to get invited, you know, back for maybe a second interview. There were three to four times, I mean, they got the jobs three or four times over the blacks. Let's just assume that racism is alive and well and that it's something that ought to be overcome through something like continuing affirmative action of the strong variety. I mean, there's some reasons to think that maybe we should still be in this business. Now I've got the following question. How do I know when strong affirmative action should quit? I mean, how do I know that I've achieved the golden age? How do I know that I finally have an egalitarian society like the kind I'm seeking here, such that I can say, okay, we can quit this strong affirmative action now? I mean, I would say that unless I can answer that, I'm just sort of off on an infinite train here. Like, how would I know that I've achieved it? Well, I'm in trouble here. But let me just try out something tentatively on you. I would like to offer as a criterion of achievement of the egalitarian society we're seeking, a criterion, is that we know we can quit this strong affirmative action when the percentage of blacks in the various the kind of jobs you can have, the various levels and hierarchy of businesses and in the professions, when the percentage of blacks in those occupations approximates the percentage of blacks in the population at large. Now, I can just hear you saying, okay, but let me just tell you that I know the other side. I am not offering this, what I'll call proportional representation. Let's just baptize that. That's what I'm talking about. This proportional representation, where the amount of blacks, let's say, in medicine and law and so forth, is equivalent to the amount of blacks, let's say, in the population of the arts. Let's call it proportional representation. I'm not offering that as a knockdown haymaker test to show that to the extent that we're far from it, that's evidence of discrimination. Look, I mean, I know better than that. But here's some test cases. If you went, just go to New York. What you're going to end up finding, let's just take a look at tugboat operators. Surprise, surprise, 90% of tugboat operators, I guess, in New York Harbor are Swedish. Now, I want to ask this question here. Why is it that we got 90% Swedes running tugboats? Is 90% of New York population Swedes? Well, there must be discrimination going on here. Must be. How else would you account for this? How about black universities like Howard University? God, they have a pittance, probably less than 2% white profs on their teaching faculty. Why is that? It's all out of whack with respect to the availability of trained white. I mean, they're obviously discriminating. Well, that's just stupid. I'm not willing to say that. Probably the Jews and the Germans and the Italians and the Dutch and the blacks that live in New York City don't care zippo about running tugboats. And so one of the reasons you don't have them as tugboat captains is because they're not interested, right? Probably that's the same answer as to why you have so few white profs at black universities. They'd probably rather not teach it because they're not well-heeled universities with all the kind of apparatus and computers that you'd like to have that you could have elsewhere. So, I mean, you can't simply say, you have a manifest imbalance in the amount of blacks or something, you know, in your corporation. Therefore, you must be prejudiced. Okay, I don't believe that. But look, guys, chew on these statistics. This is true. Right now, of the 2 million engineers in the United States, approximately 2% are black. Of approximately 250,000 physical scientists in this country, 3% are black. Only 1.5% of the lawyers in the nation's largest law firms are black. And I don't think you can say that education accounts for this disparity in pay and position. In 1982, a white head of household with a high school degree earned more than a black male with a college degree. Now, all I'm suggesting is that, in the jargon of Washington, this doesn't pass the smell test. Those statistics are wacko. They don't smell right. And so I'm not going to offer this proportional representation as the canon or criterion for having achieved the golden age. I'm not offering it as a knockdown criterion of having arrived. I'm simply offering it as presumptive evidence that if we have these kind of aberrations that we're talking about in statistics, that I don't think it passes the smell test. And therefore, it indicates that some work needs to be done. Okay, enough. Let me run. Here's what I want to do. I'll put myself in the position of somebody that wants to defend strong affirmative action programs. Okay, and let me try and indicate why some objections to this, in my view, don't work. Let's take the objection that strong affirmative action is simply discrimination in reverse. Let's just start with a hard one, okay? How does this go? Well, somebody would say, look, if the central wrong at the heart of past discrimination in this country, in hiring, promoting, and so forth, the central wrong was that decisions were made as to who is going to get this job on the basis of an irrelevant criterion, namely race, that we favored whites, rather than is this party the most qualified? And if the central wrong of past discrimination was to use a non-job relevant criterion, namely race, rather than the only job relevant criterion, is this party the most qualified, then what this objection says is that if now you start giving preferential treatment on the basis of race rather than whether the party's the most qualified, you're just committing the same sin in reverse. Right? Well, let me try some replies to this. I think there really is a big difference, first of all, in the reasons which drove or were behind the discriminatory practice of yesteryear and the reasons that try and justify color-conscious preferential treatment of blacks at the heart of strong affirmative action. The original discrimination against blacks, I think, stemmed from the view that blacks are inherently inferior to whites, they're permanently less competent than whites, and that their nature-given place is to serve whites, and that association with them demean one or defile one. Now look, those are not the reasons behind giving preferential treatment through strong affirmative action. It's not based on any invidious contempt for white males. It isn't. Rather, it's based on a premise that white males, I think, are currently in an advantaged position and that others should have an equal opportunity to achieve the same advantages. In other words, the original discrimination was aimed at destroying equal opportunity, and the sort of favoritism operative in strong affirmative action is aimed at restoring equal opportunity. So they're really not the same beast. The second reply I would give to this notion that strong affirmative action nothing but reverse discrimination is that I would challenge the question, the factual issue, as to whether we do now or ever in the past have ever really been committed to the criterion that it is only the best qualified person that should get the job. Now I'm challenging as to whether we ever really practiced that. Look, veterans have gotten preference for jobs for years. And giving preference to veterans at some times means that more qualified people than the veterans get the job. That's not giving it to the best qualified. Seniority-based selection for training and promotion and retention is commonly practiced in business based on seniority, but seniority is simply based on how many years of service you've logged in. It's not based on your evaluation of your job performance. This old boys network, which has been the way of recruiting and so forth, I mean, that doesn't necessarily turn out the most competent. It's simply Uncle Harry's, you know, friend that ends up getting the job. I think that factually that we've never really been committed to this notion that the job ought to go to the most qualified. Now, let's say, well, even if we haven't, let's just change our ways and start now and simply saying from now on the job should only be given to that on the basis of the job relevant criterion, namely you're only going to give it to the most qualified. Now we're saying we should do this. I now present to you an interesting question. Let's just suppose, fantasy wise, that the federal Congress passed a law that in January 1, 1996, it will be a criminal offense for any business to give favoritistic treatment to any blacks or Hispanics or anything, and that one must henceforth hire simply on the basis of whether they're the most qualified. Let's suppose it became illegal. Here's an interesting thought question. Do you think that if that law were to kick in, that we would immediately see people being hired on the basis of pure competence? I really doubt that. Which means, again, I think there's work to be done. Here's another interesting issue. I'm replying to this notion that favoritistic treatment fudges the principle that you should only give it to the most qualified. philosophers, like ever since Plato, have tried to ask, you know, the why daddy question, keep why that. You're looking for the supposition behind the supposition behind the supposition. Let's just ask why in business we would want to have a criterion that only the best qualified should get the job. Now, your instincts say, well, because they deserve it. Well, hold it. Wait. No. Why do we want the best qualified? Well, let me take a guess. I think we want the most qualified, walk with me on this, because the hunch is the more qualified the person, the more productive they're going to be, and the more efficient contributor to what the business is about, namely maximizing profits for the shareholders. You follow me? I mean, I can't figure out how you'd want, why you try and justify that jobs should go to the most qualified unless you thought that they were going to be more productive, more efficient producers of the goods or services that the company is producing, and therefore better money makers for the company, and the reason for being a business, therefore, is to maximize profits for shareholders. Now we understand why qualifications play a part. Wow, I could just see Plato coming in and said, well, is that the fundamental reason for being a business? To maximize profits for shareholders? You say, well, like with Milton Friedman down here in Chicago. Yeah, you got something else in mind? Somebody might come in, I mean, I could see Plato coming in and say, well, hold it. Let's get this straight here. You know, what seems patently apparent is that really you can't start a corporation unless the state licenses you. I mean, you have to fill out certain articles of incorporation and you have to sort of get the big P permission, you know, from the state to do business. To do business means having the ability to use both natural resources and human resources as part of a machine that produces goods and services that produces profits. So you got to be licensed by the state. Now that's sort of interesting, I think Plato would point out, because it shows that in the beginning, there was society. And society made some sort of decision that business might be good for it. Okay? That it might, if we had business, free enterprise, and so forth, that it might lead to a better life for the community. I mean, why would a state license that? And, I mean, would it? It must be because the state or the business would be looked upon as a way of bettering our life together. And we already see that that's probably true, because to simply say, well, the purpose of business is to maximize profits for shareholders, you can't go around maximizing profits for shareholders by just doing anything. I mean, if you're out there polluting the air, maximizing profits for shareholders, they're going to move in the big guns because that's deleterious to society, right? I mean, if you're making toys that are going to be injurious to children, they're going to blow the whistle on you. Who does this? The state. Well, this really says something. Yeah, you are free to go ahead and maximize profits for shareholders, but not if you're doing something which is deleterious to the society which licensed you in the first place. So it shows really who's in a saddle. Well, where are we going with this? Business could be looked upon in this particular view as a mechanism for bringing about a good society. And when it's involved in operations that challenge as to whether a good society will be brought about, injured parties, pollutions, and so forth, we blow the whistle on it. Why can't you, and I think Plato would probably walk this way, simply say, well, let's just take this perception and run with it. Let's concede that jobs are an important resource, that without adequate jobs, you don't have adequate income and adequate opportunities and so forth. If business is part of society and is there to help society, then business ought to be stuck with the obligation to bringing about a more just society in the future, right? See how this argument goes? It's there to serve society, isn't it? The business should be obligated to bring about a more just society in the future, which is what we're seeing, which means that if we want finally this egalitarian, equal distribution of opportunities and so forth in the future, maybe business has to fudge its standards of hiring the most qualified for the sake of hiring, getting on board various minorities and so forth so as to bring this about. I mean, why is, now maybe you'll have to fudge the most qualified in order to bring that about, but then somebody will say, yeah, but then the productivity is going down. That's now a factual issue. Is it really true that when you hire blacks for these various positions, and no one is talking about hiring unqualified, no one is talking about hiring unqualified. We're talking about people who have, you know, gotten over the threshold of being basically qualified. Is it really true that business is going to go to hell in a handbasket if it hires a basically qualified black over a more qualified white? I mean, really, are we going to go a tailspin in terms of efficiency? The statistics that I read show that that is just a bogus worry. That really is not, in fact, the case.
You've been talking about all this stuff. I think a lot of us agree with you. But what we need to do is help those that are in these places become friends with us. There's a lawyer group in a major city, I don't remember which one, that was on TV the other day, that the lawyers for black, the black lawyers and white lawyers are teaming up to become friends. They get together once a week and have lunch together. If they hit it off, they invite each other to each other's houses. These blacks say they have never been in the white people's houses. Whites have never been in the black people's houses. What we need to do is get so we know each other, because these people that are black that are in these organizations are very lonely. They don't have anyone else that they can talk to. And unless we start bridging that and getting some common grounds, we aren't ever going to be something that is a nicely mix of a tossed salad in every place that we go.
Here's the issue from a lawmaker's perspective. I mean, I often think there's an analog to Newton's second law for every reaction, Newton's one of his laws is that the natural state of a body is at rest unless moved by another one. I think that most lawmakers probably think that's the truth in the social sphere too. This may be the ideal. I mean, let's get together and talk. But the question is, can you depend on people's good graces to do this?
No.
Right. So now we got room for the law to come in and force behavior which might not be voluntarily forthcoming, which is, this is how the law gets into business. I mean, we can idealize about this, but.
You used the term basically qualified versus the most qualified. The employer that I work for is a bank, and we use the term fully qualified versus the most qualified. And if we can find a black person that is fully qualified, we will hire them.
What is the difference between fully and most?
Fully would be that they can do the job and they can do it to your satisfaction and do a good job. The most qualified would be the person perhaps with the most education or background. They could be overqualified and not be a good fit.
That's very interesting, because I think what your bank is doing is conceding that one of the strategies which a racist employer could use is to trot out basic qualifications for the job, which are wacko. I mean, you don't need this many qualifications, and you can safely keep blacks at bay because very few of them are going to meet this. But then if you ask, are these job relevant? No, I don't need a master's. I don't need a PhD to be a teller in a bank or something. I think that's really a neat move. How about this objection? Strong affirmative action leads to resentment, social tensions. It creates a more polarized society rather than a more harmonious one. So it's delivering exactly the opposite of what you want to bring about. Well, I guess my first reaction to that would be, I think the same thing could have been said about the original civil rights and feminist movements. Think about all the name-calling, rock-throwing, when blacks first tried to integrate public schools, buses, and lunch collars, right? Think about the bra-burning women's liber jokes that started to be told, you know, around, you know, men's rooms when women began demanding equal pay for equal work. Here they come out of the woodwork. Well, I guess if somebody's going to be offended by it, we better drop it, huh? That doesn't strike me as a very good reason I think what the resentment and tension show is pervasive racism and sexism and not the wrongness of strong affirmative action. I mean, it doesn't cut any ice with me. There's another objection, which I'll simply cite and would reply to, but I want to get you in the melee here. Somebody might say, look, why don't we always just pick on the blacks? You know, in the history of this country, there's been a lot of discriminated against groups. The Jews, the Germans, the Italians, right? The Irish. Now, we didn't have strong affirmative action programs. They gradually assimilated. They made it. So why do we have to have for blacks? I think there are some replies to this. I won't go into them. Let me just take up one more and then just sort of throw it open. Here's an objection. Strong affirmative action hurts the psyche of blacks. It causes a loss of self-esteem and the onset of self-doubt. Now, this objection says that the black who's hired because of favoritistic treatment of strong affirmative action knows that he or she has probably been hired because his policy's there, not because they're the most qualified, and are going to look themselves in a bathroom mirror and say, I'm not where I am on the basis of my own merits. I'm really a second-class citizen, and I feel like crap. And you're just going to decimate the black psyche. You understand this? I mean, so it's really not doing good for those for whom we want to do good. I don't doubt that some blacks feel this way. A black by the name of Shelby Steele wrote a book a while back which parades the amount of blacks that feel really put down by being ensconced in positions through this. But that's not the whole story. I know blacks who don't feel that way at all. They simply say, I don't feel bad about being gotten in on a favoritistic treatment. It's about time. They owe me one. Also, I think, it's hard for me to believe that this isn't true, that some blacks don't voice or feel what a woman in one of my classes said a number of years ago. And I put it, the question to the class, to the women in the class, I says, well, how would you feel if you knew that you got some position mainly because you're a woman and not because you were the most qualified for the job? You were qualified, but not the most qualified. Wouldn't that make you feel like crap? And this one woman, she came and says, nah, I wouldn't. All I want is just to get my foot in the door and then watch them. I'm going to knock their socks off.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, just give me a chance and I'll show you that I can measure up to your highest standards. All I want is a chance. So I'm not sure that this objection, which is we're going to ruin the black psyche and lower their self-esteem, you know, really works. Jump into this. What do you think? I mean, the issue before the House is whether you think we should or should not put a sunset clause on strong affirmative action, because that's what's coming down the pipe with Pete Wilson and maybe Newt. Where are you people on this issue?
I work for a large corporation, and I know that we go back to the white male. I've seen, you know, in 15 years, I've seen more women, many more minorities, Southeast Asian as well as black. And the company is making a
And if they weren't forced into this,
right,
that they go right back to the standard old ways?
Yeah, I really think so.
Anybody else have a different experience? I mean, an experience which would certify the other approach, which would simply say that we've come a long way since the beginning of the civil rights movement, that legal mechanisms which force the door to be held open for blacks and so forth aren't really necessary anymore. The door is open of its own. I mean, is there any evidence of that? No?
Yeah, so I think people here believe in what you're saying.
Everybody does?
I think the people in this room do.
What has affirmative action done for integration? You know, has it put a bigger rift between black and whites? I don't know. I'm asking.
My hunch is that it probably has helped.
Helped. I see more black and white kids walking down the street together. I see more mixes of kids playing together. I'm a teacher. I see more kids running together for a campaign that are a mixed bag of colors.
So what does this mean? Prejudice is pretty much licked?
No, but we're getting better. They're finding out that there's more we have alike than we have different. It's not everybody happy. On the West Coast, I think it's better than down south. I was down in Port Gibson this last spring, and it was a town where you go into one side of it, and it was black. You go over a bridge, and it was the whites. And I had never, ever felt that before because I live on the West Coast. And it really is still black-white town in that section of the state of Louisiana.